Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, December 26th. I'm Ray Graff. If you're going by the calendar, winter not even a week old, but of course the seasonal weather made an early arrival in our region. With one major snowstorm already under our belts this season, we welcome back meteorologist Jason Goff to answer your weather questions. Formerly of News Channel 13 in Albany, Jason now runs a forecasting website at jasonsweather.com. So if you have a question about snow squalls, lake effect, blizzards, the polar vortex, whatever, give us a call. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us as well at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Meteorologist Jason Goff and your weather calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We're joined again today by meteorologist Jason Goff for a discussion about the weather, including that major snowstorm that dumped about 2 feet of snow on the region after Thanksgiving, and also what may be in store for us this winter. Formerly of News Channel 13 in Albany, Jason now runs a forecasting website at jasonsweather.com. If you have a question about the weather, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Jason Goff, welcome back to the show, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. Nice to see you. Did you get those headphones for Christmas? Those things are looking high-tech, man.
Oh, you know, these are old COS Pro AAs. And
they are sporty.
I'll tell you one thing. I bought them maybe. I use them here as my studio phones. I had them for a few years. This design goes back to the 70s.
They look great. It looks like something that came out of the Hurricane Hunters or something.
You can still get them, too.
That's great.
And it blocks out most of the sound. So if I'm sitting in the studio before we go on and people are talking to me, I have to take them off. And it's very handy, depending on who's in the studio with you.
I'm sure.
By the way, sure. Speaking of that, thank you for calling us during the snowstorm on the roundtable.
Hey, I was happy to do that. As I was saying before, I was around a lot of very smart people. I felt, took me a couple of weeks to learn how to tie my own shoes. Maybe I was a little misplaced, but it worked out.
You know, as we discussed during that storm, and you were on that morning when it was the heaviest or was about to get really bad, I was amazed, and not amazed, but very impressed with the quality of the forecasting leading into that storm. It went back several days before, mm-hmm. and most of the major meteorologists that I saw nailed it.
Yeah, it was good. It was a little bit of an interesting storm in that we had it kind of in two pieces.
Yeah.
And it snowed. Albany had 38 consecutive hours of snow.
It was crazy.
And it was good. I mean, number 4 all-time December, number 8 all-time period.
Yeah.
For snowfall. So that was pretty impressive.
But the models are getting better. I mean, all I can say is 3 or 4 days out, they said you will probably get 20 some odd inches. I think we had more than that where I lived. A couple of more, but it was very close, and it was a few days out that they had this.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, if you look at the models overall, the averages, they've improved about 1 day per decade. So in other words, what was a solid 3-day forecast in the 90s is now a solid 5-day forecast here in, you know, as we're actually getting rid of the 2010s.
Yeah.
But the models have done well. They continue to improve. And, and these types of systems are always our toughest. Like, this is the hardest time of year to forecast around here because of the variability of these nor'easters.
I know we've talked about this before, but that to me seems counterintuitive because in the summer, ostensibly, you have more energy, you have more heat.
Right.
And to me, that would mean more volatility, but I guess I'm wrong about that.
No, it's a good point. It's just kind of from looking at it through a different angle. But at the end of the day, really what happens in the summertime is that just like people, or, you know, I like to bass fish in the summer, bass slow down when the water gets real warm.
Yeah.
The atmosphere slows down too in the summertime. So the jet stream tends to lift a little farther north, so you're losing that energy. We can still have a robust day to be sure. I mean, you remember this past August, the weather was open for business a good chunk
indeed.
Of the month.
Yep.
But overall, you have more energy, more dynamics available once we get into the transitional seasons and then, of course, with winter in between. So things get get a little cranky sometimes.
Meteorologist Jason Goff is our guest today on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551 if you have a question. And before we get to the calls and the email, how is jasonsweather.com going along?
It's been going great. I really, you know, I get out of bed every morning at 4, anywhere from 4 to 4:15, depending on the weather, and I send an email out to anybody that signs up. So this morning it went out to about 2,040 people.
But you have to customize that, right?
Well, it gets sent out, and it's the whole purpose of the email is just a quick snapshot. Like, hey, this is the deal for the day.
Right.
And then I'll just put a couple of other little things in there, like, you know, I talked about this morning. You know, if you want to check out the forecast through the weekend, we have rain coming Sunday and, you know, through New Year's Eve. Then you can just then they can click on to the entire forecast that I had.
Oh, that's pretty great. So you don't have an intern yet to wake up at 4 a.m. and do that for you?
No, not yet. We're a little far away from that as yet.
Jason Goff is our guest. We have an email here, and then we'll jump on the phones. Could Jason please explain why the potential for melting snow varies with relative humidity, assuming temperature is held constant?
That's a good question, and we saw a really good example of that after that storm in early December. Right, we had a huge, thick snowpack for early December in these parts, and then we got into some mild weather. We had the rain, but it's the humidity. Fog just chews up snow. Now, if you have, obviously, you have to have good dew points, high dew points to get rain. And so what we look at is what we call the dew point depression, which is the difference in temperature, the difference between the air temperature and the dew point temperature.
Right.
And as that dew point depression gets smaller, then that means that the air is more humid. So just think about, you know, relative humidity getting to 100%, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is, in essence, it's almost like if you were, let's say you were out, whatever, running a 5K or something in the rain, and
not
it's
likely.
Cold.
Okay,
yeah, me neither.
By the premise, sure.
But you're out and you're doing whatever, and it's just really cold, and you just want to go and sit in a hot bath. So you're sort of enveloped by this warm water, and that helps to bring up your extremities and eventually your core. Kind of the same thing with snow. So you have this humidity, this higher levels of humidity, and it in essence helps to melt that snow off, and you're going to have temperatures that are above freezing anyway.
Right.
Now, if you have a good solid rain, like we're going to have on Sunday, that the snowpack, depending on how thick it is, how deep it is going to be able to absorb a lot of that rain. So if you are, let's say, the manager of a ski mountain, you would rather have a shot of heavy rain get in and out than to have a couple of days where we're in the 40s and it's overcast and foggy, because that's what's going to really chew up your snowpack.
Jason Goff is our guest. Let's grab a call or two before the first break. 800-348-2551. We started out with Kerry in Plainfield, Mass. Kerry, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Jason.
Hey,
I hope you both had good holidays. Okay. What I want to say is, you know, I know officially spring begins in March, but I hear people who don't care for winter, they're usually complaining how long the winter is.
And guilty, yes.
I know spring, you know, begins in March, but for me, I really look forward to the second, third week of February, because if the weather's cooperating, the sap from the maple trees are going to start to flow and the maple sugaring season begins. And, you know, at that time, it seems like the temperatures are getting more mild, the sun's up higher, and, you know, in a very short time, you're going to start seeing crocus coming up through the snow, batches of snow.
Yeah, yeah, you can do that for sure.
It's a good feeling for me, you know, that spring's not far away at that point.
No, I understand. And yeah, certainly the sun angle is higher, and when you get those good days where you can get the sap flowing, when we've got those cold, calm nights and then the milder days, and then, you know, St. Patrick's Day in spring is a month away. I hear you.
There you go.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Kerry. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's a call-in show, Vox Pop. Jason Goff is our guest. And let's go to Wayne and Wendell. Wayne, you're on.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, what is the difference between a meteorologist and a weatherman? My wife says they are the same, and I disagree with her.
They could be the same.
Did you have a bet of any kind?
No.
Oh, man, that's too bad. I could have helped you win a bet because you are correct. I would say off the bat, the difference between a meteorologist and a weatherman is partial differential equations, for one.
great.
Yeah, meteorologist, you know, go through the schooling. And I always, you know, I've told students this before many times that are thinking about dabbling in meteorology. And my first question to them is always, how's your math? Because once you get past that first class, and that's, you know, it's all good. You're talking about cold fronts and
right. This
is how hurricanes form. And then you get into the second semester and beyond and you go, wait a minute here. What in the wide world of sports is going on? I've got all these things going. So, yeah, when you get into, as I mentioned, dynamics before, that's tricky stuff. You've got a lot of physics and you've got a lot of math. Whereas a forecaster, there are certain programs you can take courses online. Mississippi State is one of those that was kind of notorious for a while. People were kind of turning their noses up at them. But it's just like anything else. You do with your degree what you do, and you have to be motivated to learn more. But that's the distinct difference, is that there is an actual degree in meteorology, whereas you can have other people that back in the old days, they used to call them rip and read.
Sure.
Because you'd rip the forecast off the teletype, and you'd read it, and
yeah,
that was it.
You know, but you – okay, distinction being made, and we know that that's true about meteorologists. However, when you're on TV and you're a meteorologist, you're also a weatherman.
Of course, yeah. And, you know, look, I've been called a lot worse than a weatherman,
yeah,
I assure you.
Including in this room.
that's just fine. And that's the other thing, too, is that all of that stuff, all these things that we learned and, you know, deriving the omega equation and learning about, you know, vorticity, advection and all this stuff, buoyancy and good grief, I'm having flashbacks already.
Back in the old days when I was a kid in this market, it was all a weatherman. You had a guy on, he was a gregarious fellow, he would read
them.
I think Kovacic was one of the first I remember who was a meteorologist who would jump on, and we said, well, this is new.
Yeah, it's something that's a little different, and it started to evolve a little more as forecasting became better. Then you had more things available to people that could actually read, you know, and interpret forecasts as opposed to reading something that the Weather Service spit out.
Right. Let's take a break here. Jason Goff is our guest. He's a meteorologist. He's a weatherman. He's everything. And we'll have more of your questions coming up. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Meteorologist Jason Goff is our guest. Jason of jasonsweather.com fame. And let's see. How does it look for the New Year's Eve, New Year's Day?
It's looking good. We're going to have a cold front that'll come through on Monday and kind of shut off all of this stuff that's going to be here.
What's going to be here?
So we'll have on Sunday... The models have actually been pushing off the start of the precip until, you know, around noontime or beyond.
Tomorrow?
This is on Sunday.
Ah.
So, yeah, tomorrow's a different story. We can talk about that, too, because we do have some winter weather advisories. But anyway, we'll have a front that'll come through on Monday and really kind of quiet things down. The timing is good. So it'll be chilly but not cold.
Yep.
And it'll be dry, which
okay,
is what all
great.
Of, you know, you got first night Bethlehem, first night Saratoga. And then, of course, you know, just people out and about going to house parties and stuff. So the weather will be in good shape.
How are we looking for the next 24?
Through the next 24 hours, things will be a little dicey in the morning, especially as you head like out the thruway through Schenectady County, up into the Mohawk Valley, and then even over to the Rensselaer Plateau. Those are areas that tend to keep colder air trapped in these little sheltered valleys and things. So it's not going to rain real heavily, but you don't need much. A little goes a long way when you're talking about freezing rain.
Yeah.
Just a little glaze, obviously, will put you on your keister, or, you know, you could get into some issues on the roads if they're not treated.
But this will not be cataclysmic.
No, not at all. But it's always something to be, you know, it's always something that you've got to keep an eye on, because, as I said, just a thin little patch of ice somewhere could really alter the course of your day.
In my view, there's always a good reason to stay home.
That's a fact.
Our number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Meteorologist Jason Goff is our guest, and Howard is in New Paltz. Howard, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I just have a strange question. When you look at a hurricane from above, I'm trying to remember which way it spins. Does it spin the same way as a sink goes down the drain? And is there a way, maybe someday, a way of interfering with that spin and lessening the force of a hurricane?
In theory, yes. In reality, no. In terms of trying to disrupt a hurricane.
What kind of theory?
I heard
a prominent person mention atomic bombs.
Yeah, well, again, not talking about the sharpest knife in the drawer.
Okay.
There. So as you talk about, you know, ultimately what'll choke off a hurricane is drier air. So that's why they'll die off quickly, at least in terms of development. I mean, obviously they still do a lot of damage as they make their way inland, but the wind dies down quickly as the storm gets its strength from the warm water. You remove that from the equation and it starts to weaken the hurricane. There was a project in the, I think it was in the late 60s, called Project Storm Fury. And the idea was to be able to, in essence, have a hurricane drown itself out.
Yeah.
To put a lot of particles into the storm. That would incite more precipitation, more rain. And it would rain like crazy out over the ocean, and it wouldn't come in, you know, along the shoreline and flood people out. But it's difficult to describe and certainly difficult for people to grasp just how incredibly huge and powerful these storms are. And they're going to go wherever they want. But they do. The hurricanes are an extreme example of an area of low pressure, and they rotate counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere, clockwise in the southern hemisphere. Hopefully that answers your question.
Well, he's dead silent. All right, Howard, thanks for the call. This project, what was it, Storm?
Project Storm Fury.
Okay, Project Storm Fury. What were the particles they were going to seed the clouds with?
Now it slips my mind. It was some sort of an ammonia solid. It was a solid, and it's right on the tip of my tongue.
It doesn't matter.
But anyway.
The idea was it would get the moisture to cling to these particles?
Yeah, you in essence are trying to speed up the condensation piece. And condensation ultimately is what drives these storms, because as you have water vapor, right, that condenses, you remember the water cycle, as it condenses, it releases heat,
yeah.
Right? You have to remove heat from a gas to make it into a liquid. So that's what's going on. And then that heat in turn heats up more and it continues to feed the storm. So if you get to the point, and there was not totally similar, but there was a cloud seeding experiment that was done over the Berkshires.
In the
50s? In the 40s or 50s, yeah. It was. And it was actually born out of UAlbany.
Mm-hmm.
Vincent Schaefer was the fellow that did that. And they worked in a lot with GE at that time. And the idea was to have them seed the clouds and to be able to accelerate the snowfall. And that is to, if you had a cloud that maybe was just dropping a couple of flurries, you could drop these crystals in there, and that would help to bring more snow out of the cloud.
And why would you want to accelerate the snowfall?
Well, the idea, I suppose, is to control the weather and to try to, you know, do this and do that. But it's just, you know, for people to want to control the weather, that's fine. But wants and abilities are two totally different things.
But they've tried, again, throughout the decades with cloud seeding, right? In dry areas?
They have.
To some success, you know?
Yeah, but the problem is that the scope of these things, and there's so much variability anyway in them. I mean, if it's difficult to nail down a forecast sometimes out to a couple of days, it's going to be even harder to not only nail a forecast, but be in the right place at the right time, conduct the experiments with all the variables that you have going on all at once.
Yep.
It's just a very difficult task.
We are joined today by Jason Goff of jasonsweather.com. The number, if you have a weather question, is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Kellen in Glens Falls. Kellen, you're on.
Hi, Jason, and good to talk to you guys.
You too. Thank you.
I remember when I was younger, my father came home with a laser disc of the movie Twister, and I was wondering. I had a couple questions. Number one, is that movie accurate? You know, is that like a feasible cast to be able to track tornadoes like that? And number two, I remember there's a scene in there where the tornado's picking up cows.
Yes.
And I was wondering, what is the, you know, like, what's the heaviest object that a tornado can lift? Yeah, I know they're pretty powerful.
Ah.
But I'm going to hang up now and listen on the radio.
All right, thanks a lot. Good, I love talking about twisters.
Yeah, well, To be fair, I think I saw that movie when it first came out. Maybe it was like late 90s, if I remember.
I never saw it.
So I don't really remember. I know certainly that, you know, Hollywood is going to do its thing, and it's going to want to be able to make things look a lot simpler than they really are.
Right.
The technology from then, if I remember right, they were trying to place these sensors down to get an accuracy, because nobody's really gotten... Although we're waiting for a report to come out where they actually did, they're talking about now flying drones into tornadoes if they can to try to get reading. Because, you know, ultimately you want to know how these things tick internally, and that's just not an easy thing to do. So, but they, you know, some of these storm chasers, they're out and they've got these cars that are really, really low to the ground and they're super heavy and they're fortified and all of that. So, you know, there's always going to be the Hollywoodization of these types of things. But ultimately, the goal of all of the men and women who study these things, and they're out in the field or they're in the classroom or both, is to try to get as many readings out of these storms as they can, because then you can sort of work backwards in a sense and try to figure out, well, why did this storm drop a tornado and this one did not? Even though the one that did maybe wasn't as strong as the other one. There's so many different things that are going on. Now, as far as what these things can lift, you know, when you see some of these massive tornadoes out in Oklahoma, for example, these EF5s that hit, it seem, you know, every other year or whatever, and you see the paths of these where these things have gone. I mean, you're talking about a mile wide or more of these things, which to me is just, I can't even wrap my head around that.
A mile wide tornado.
And unfortunately, the larger a tornado, the stronger it is. So it's not like, you know, it'd be nice if it was the other way around, where you have these thin little tornadoes that have all this strong wind. The bigger they are, the stronger they are. And it literally looks like somebody came in with a big front end loader or a big, you know, one of those, you see them at construction sites with these big sweepers in the front. And they just take these houses right off the foundations. I mean, there's literally dirt where a slab of a house once stood.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, they can do a lot of damage just certainly by lifting these things up, and they're just not something to play around with, obviously.
There have been reports, many apocryphal over the centuries, of fish landing, fish being raining down, and I assume that there is something at play similar to that, where they're picked up by a weather system and taken through the air.
I've heard of that before. There was, you heard anecdotally, perhaps in reality, about, you know, alligators landing here and there of a tornado that hit in Florida or the Carolinas. You know, you might find an alligator 5 miles inland. But I remember the Springfield tornado hit in 2011, and they were finding, you know, pieces of paper, you know, like power bills and pictures and stuff over to Worcester.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. So, you know, you can get these strong winds and they'll carry these things just in the field as they go up. They just keep on trucking and all that stuff kind of gets thrown out that way. It's really something else. You know, to even try to fathom the power of these things is just something else.
Meteorologist Jason Goff is our guest. The number here on Vox Pop is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You mentioned investigators maybe thinking about flying a drone into a tornado. A couple of questions there. One, in the center, is it like a hurricane eye where there's a relative spot of peace?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the theory in essence. But, yeah, you've got that really tight, strong rotation. So how they would be able to do that is a different story.
You have to sacrifice the drone, I'm thinking.
Yes, but if you have some kind of a housing element that is able to protect the instruments at least long enough for them to be able to transmit what it is that they're measuring, you know, humidity levels, temperature, all these pressure, certainly all these types of things. And if they can get radioed back so that they can have an idea what's actually going on in these storms.
And what is the mystery? In other words, are they wondering, is the barometric pressure different in the center of these?
Well, it's going to be at its lowest in the center, because that is basically where everything is just going to be in, you know, everything is just going to be rolling along. In a hurricane, for example, because just think about it in a different context. In a hurricane, you have the eye of the storm. In that eye of the storm, you actually have higher pressure because it's a sinking motion. So that's why on a bright sunny day when you have no clouds in the sky, that's a big ridge of high pressure. So the area of low pressure that's swirling around all of that overall, it's just really something. But again, you're talking about really low pressure. So to be able to try to figure out what's going on inside of a tornado might help to try to figure out how these things really get going in the first place.
And how to predict them.
Yeah, that's the key, is to try to predict them.
And why is it that hurricanes will often spawn tornadoes on the edges?
Just friction. As it makes its way onto land, you figure, you know, as they move out over the water, you don't have a lot of extra surface area, right? You just basically have the water. As you make your way onto land, then you have everything that the land has, cars and trees and roads and houses and all that sort of thing. So what'll happen is as those winds get going, you'll start to get these little eddies, especially in the outer fringes of the storm. And you will always have some kind of tornadic activity with a landfalling storm, some more than others. Some of them won't spawn a lot. Others will spawn a bunch.
But why then are tornadoes so common in the middle of the country where there's no water, no ocean?
That's a whole different ballgame. In terms of how those storms form, they're forming from a much different mechanism. These tornadoes are generally just a byproduct of the hurricane itself, if you want to think of it like that, where they make their way onto land.
And they hit friction. And that causes the spin.
That'll cause a spin, and then it'll cause, you know, these columns of air to get kind of tilted down. And, of course, you know, it's difficult sometimes to say, well, was the damage of this house caused by a tornado, or was it caused by the straight line winds coming out of this storm? And, you know, there's just a lot of different ways to strike out in a hurricane if it's going to be making landfall close by.
And I guess you're right. If you're sitting in a house, it doesn't really matter whether it's a microburst or it's a tornado.
Yeah, just wind is wind. It just, you know, when Dorian hit the Bahamas, you in essence had an EF3 tornado for 24 hours going on because the winds were sustained at 180 miles an hour. You had gusts over 200. Tornadoes, that's the other piece about those storms, is that people don't realize how fast they get in and get out. I mean, you're talking 20, 30 seconds,
yeah,
and it's done.
Yeah.
It's out of there. For this, I mean, it's just basically like a giant vacuum cleaner, those folks, because that storm just did not move. It just hung out. And it's going to take years for that area. And I've been fishing. I have pictures of that harbor where we actually stayed a couple of years ago and went fishing over there, and it's just gone. I can't even imagine.
You know, you had mentioned on a previous show the Long Island Express, that hurricane 32 or whatever year it was.
Yep.
And you had mentioned that was like winds inside the storm doing 100 plus and the storm itself moving 60, 70 miles
yes,
an hour.
That was
and
the problem.
I think you alluded to a comparison between tornadoes and that storm as well, being a very long tornado.
It basically was, and it had moved because the forward speed. Now, it's not like a linear thing where you can add up, you know,
right,
say, well, 100-mile-an-hour winds moving 60 miles an hour doesn't quite work that way. But the fact that it was moving so quickly and the fact that it happened before there was a satellite in the sky, you know, that was a really devastating storm, and a lot of people lost their lives, especially in Rhode Island from that. Because Narragansett Bay, in essence, was pushed inland, the 20-foot storm surge there.
Meteorologist Jason Goff is our guest. The number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. If you have a weather question, let's take a quick break. We'll get back to the phones. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Numbers 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We talk weather today with meteorologist Jason Goff of jasonsweather.com. This one came in via email from Mike in Hinsdale. When Paul Caiano gives us weather, why does he divide the weather between north of I-90 and south of I-90?
Well, I don't know what he does with his forecast, but just in terms of being able to, like for me, for example, when I'm putting out a forecast and it's written or if I even do a little video of it, you want to give people a point of reference because you're talking about, you know, I generally cover 14 counties. Now with the WAMC listeners, I'll extend a little farther to the south because we have a lot of listeners down from Ulster, Dutchess counties,
yep,
and down that way, which is not part of the Albany television market.
Right.
So as you try to put out a forecast, you want to have people at least have an idea of some context with your weather. So today's a perfect example. So we have these winter weather advisories that are in effect for Schenectady County out the Mohawk Valley, which in essence is the thruway westbound, and then up into the Adirondacks. And then when you get up that way, especially in the northern Mohawk Valley, you start to go up in elevation. Elevation is one of those things that can help to trigger more precipitation. So there's that's always a consideration. So just in terms of trying to let people know sort of what's going to be going on here or there,
yeah,
it gives them a point of reference. So it, you know, if he says, hey, I live in Hinsdale, I'm pretty far away from that, then you can say, all right, well, I don't have to worry about this so much.
You know, it's funny. We cover such a vast area, basically to the Canadian border, mm-hmm, into New Hampshire, Connecticut, down into Westchester, out to Utica. It's very tough when we're doing the newscast try to do a concise weather picture that you can get in 15, 20 seconds.
Yes, it is, especially for the WAMC listening area because,
yeah,
it is. And you're talking about – I mean, our weather can change in, you know, within a 10 or 12 mile point from the city of Albany, for example. So imagine, you know, going to Worcester where you're kind of going up over the Berkshires and then back down. Then you kind of get into the Worcester Hills, certainly going up to the Adirondacks out west. You've got a little plains. You've got the valley. So there's a lot.
Yeah.
A lot going on.
Our number is 800-348-2551. Meteorologist Jason Goff is here. And let's go back to the phones. Katie in Coxsackie. Katie.
Hi, I had a question. I was looking for a Christmas gift, and I saw a board game about terraforming, and I wanted to ask if this is something that meteorologists are actually looking into, and is it something that we think is possible?
That's a good question. I'm sure that meteorologists on some level, you know, working for some entity are maybe looking into it in terms of being able to convert whatever, you know, Mars or the moon to handle handle life on Earth. You're talking about, I mean, we have a difficult time just trying to forecast what's already here,
yeah,
let alone creating it and then forecasting it and trying to control all of that. The real big issue, and this is a good question, and especially because you can say it kind of gives you a big glimpse into the overall weather picture. There are so many variables out there. Weather on Earth is what we call an open system. So you constantly have changing things going on in the atmosphere that are influenced by all kinds of different things, as opposed to space, which is a closed system. And that's why NASA could come out and say, hey, we're going to have, I'm just making this up, we're going to have a solar eclipse on, you know, March 8th, 2095. And it's going to happen at this time and it's going to last for this long because that, you know, although there is some variability with gravity, it's not a huge thing, whereas with weather, you have lots of different things going on. So I can't pretend that I know pretty much anything about terraforming, but I would imagine that's a pretty heavy lift at this stage of our species knowledge.
Still a great call, Katie, and thank you very much. Happy holidays. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. I guess the goal then is to make weather patterns a closed system, and the only thing you can do to make that happen is to have all the variables
right,
covered.
Then you would
the
have
models to, would have to be.
You would have to, in order to close that, you would have to enclose it.
Right.
Basically, you would have to have like a, you know, something out of the movies, a biosphere.
Oh, no, really? But in other words, this isn't a conceptual closed system. In other words, if Jason Goff knew every variable that affected the weather, then it's the same thing as predicting an orbit, right?
Yeah, if you know everything, including how it may or may not change, so you have to be able to. I mean, it's think about it as an experiment, right? You always learn the scientific method. You know, you have your hypothesis and your theories and all these things, so you have to be able to have controls in there because if you don't, then, you know, things just kind of happen. It's like the Monty Python marathon where the gun goes off and everybody runs in different directions. That's kind
I remember
of thing,
that one.
Know.
Well,
so,
but I mean, the models, the goal is to put everything in there, every variable. It'll never happen to perfection,
right?
But that's the goal.
That is the goal. And the computing speed is the weakest link in that chain because you could, in theory, again, account for every variable, but by the time you made all those calculations, the period which you're going to be forecasting is already behind you.
Well, and then you'd be 100% right every
time. Hey, that's true. I can tell you tomorrow's weather on 2 days, no problem.
This is our number to call, 800-348-2551. Jason Goff is our guest. Alan is in Kingston. Alan, you're on.
Hello. Hello, Mr. Goff. And I fly, and I had learned that the adiabatic lapse rate is so many degrees up, you know, and I very seldom see it standard. And I just wondered how that helps in your forecasting for the weather. Is it a good help if it changes, you know, when you send the balloons up? It's not at all what it's supposed to be. Can you just tell me how that helps you in the forecast?
Yes, sir. It actually helps in cases like tonight. I mean, sometimes it can make for a problematic forecast, too, to try to really nail it down. But if you have warmer air aloft and colder air on the ground, you have to know how deep that cold air is to determine what you're going to be getting. Ultimately, are you going to get sleet or are you going to get freezing rain? And when the Weather Service launches those balloons, they actually draw these diagrams that are called SKU-Ts, and they are graphical representations of dew point and temperature, and that will kind of give us an idea, because when we're forecasting in for the ground, we have to know what's also going on above our heads at different slices of the atmosphere. So knowing what is going to be going on. Now, that I gave you the example for wintertime. In the summertime, we want to know what those lapse rates are, because that can determine how strong thunderstorms might be. If we've got a big lapse from, you know, temperatures as we go up, that means we have a lot of potential energy there, which means we have the potential to have, you know, a no-joke weather day. So those things are very important, and that's one of the reasons. And in fact, on days where we potentially are going to have, you know, strong storms or even tornadoes, the Weather Service offices will actually send up what they call a special balloon launch, and they'll send it out at 18Z, it was 2 o'clock, and they'll send it up just to get a better handle on what's going to be going on so that they can be prepared for what will be coming that afternoon.
Alan, thank you for the call. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Meteorologist Jason Goff is our guest. Kay is in the Berkshires. Kay.
How is ball lightning created?
Well, Kay, if I knew that, I would be ahead of a lot of scientists that have been kind of studying
something
that.
Of a mystery.
Yeah, it is. And if you, it is a phenomenon. Some people will argue that it doesn't exist.
Out of me.
Have you seen it, Kay?
Yes, it chased me right back into my house.
Yeah,
you're not alone to hear those stories are common.
No, they are, and I've read stories and for people, and there are some people that say that it doesn't exist, and then there are a lot of other people that say yes, it does. So you can go on my website, okay, to jasonsweather.com, and there's a section in there called Droppin' Knowledge, and I have an article in there about ball lightning. That'll do a much better job of explaining it than I would
What's
do right
the gist?
Now. Over the gist is, well, first of all, again, they're trying to figure out what actually causes this.
Right.
So you don't have a regular discharge, if you will, where you have basically the circuit being completed from the ground up and from the cloud down. Whereas this is something that moves very erratically, and it in essence kind of clusters together a lot of that field, and it can wreak havoc on all kinds of different things. So, but yeah, check that out. It'll explain it a lot better than I can right now on the radio.
Okay, I don't have a computer, so I gotta just take what you just said.
Okay,
Kay, let me ask you a question before you go. So
yeah?
it followed you into the house. What happened? How did you get rid of the thing?
I don't know. I went in the house. I was freaking out, and I didn't even look back.
Yikes! Well,
it was like three of them chasing me.
Well,
they came up from the valley and into my garden area, and then they just saw me, I guess, and they just started chasing me. I was out with my dogs, and
how long ago did this happen?
Huh?
How long ago did this happen?
Oh, man, let me see. We're 17 years out here. So about 20 years ago.
Whew. Well, that's a very interesting story.
It's pretty scary stuff from what the stuff that I've read, for sure.
Kay, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551 is the number. Jason Goff is our guest today on the program. And Beck in Sheffield, Mass., you're on.
You may have already answered this, but I want to know if you have any predictions for this, the rest of this winter.
I wish I did. I really don't. I don't put a lot of stock into those. I read there was a month-long prediction that comes out. So the Weather Prediction Center, they will put out, there are other agencies within NOAA that will put out different outlooks, they're called. And there's an 8 to 14 day outlook. There's a 6 to 10 day outlook. And then they'll put out monthly outlooks. And they put this out a week ago, actually a little more than a week ago, for the month of January. And sometimes those forecasts pan out and sometimes they don't. I don't like to put a whole lot of stock in them. But if this forecast were to verify, we will have a relatively cold January. It's not going to start out that way. I can say that just by looking at the models through next weekend, and then we'll see what happens. But the potential is there for a little bit of what we call high latitude blocking, where you get a big high pressure ridge over Greenland. That opens the door, at least the opportunity for us to have colder shots of air and also the opportunity for snow. We'll see how it all shakes out.
All right. Now, you know, thank you, Becky, for the call. We appreciate it. You're a numbers guy, and you have done in your college days sort of an analysis of the Old Farmer's Almanac and the way they do long-term predictions.
Yes.
And then you talk about these predictions that are shorter term, but still long-term.
Mm-hmm.
These 8 to 14 days, and what's the longer one than that?
Well, they have 30-day outlooks they'll put out.
In your estimation, what is the percentage, the accuracy of these 30-day outlooks?
That's a good question. I really don't know. I'd have to look it up because I don't pay a lot of attention to them, especially because for this part of the country, there are so many things that can change. We've talked about the polar vortex on this show many times. First of all, even forecasting when that phenomenon may happen where that the stratospheric winds slow down or actually reverse and that cold air kind of oozes south. Is it going to come over the Midwest? Is it going to come over the Northeast? Is it going to go over Europe?
Right.
That's difficult to forecast, even as we understand that it's going to happen. So that's just one example. And we could also have a good pattern at, say, 500 millibars in the atmosphere, which will help to steer some of these nor'easters. If everything sets up just right, then we're in a good spot. We can get some pretty hefty snows. But it also could be a deal where places like D.C., Philly, New York, and Boston get clobbered, and we're just a little bit too far north and west. So it's hard to forecast that even when we're starting to see these things show up on a model 5-6 days out,
yeah.
Let alone, you know, something that was issued back on December 19th, and it's a forecast for the entire month of January. But, you know,
what's the good of them then?
It's just to have an idea of the state of the global atmosphere. In order to do this, you know, because everything is so connected, and that gets all the way back to all the other things that we talk about how connected the planet is and how important it is to understand this when you're talking about climate change and global warming and all
right.
of that. So when you have ocean currents and those are adjusting and kind of kinking jet streams and doing all this sort of thing, getting an idea of what's been happening. I mean, you've heard about the heat and the fires that are going on in Australia. In many ways, that will affect the forecast for North America and just trying to figure out.
Will that mean more rain, more particulates up in the upper atmosphere?
For us, not necessarily, but it'll be nasty on the southern hemisphere, at least for those parts of it.
Jason Goff is our guest today. We talk weather on Vox Pop, and John in Pine Bush is next. John.
Yes. Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. I had two things I wanted to mention. One is, I don't know if you're familiar with the idea of an electric universe. It's an electric universe theory and how that applies to weather changes. There's a great, on the net, you could find it. There's a great explanation of it. It's called Extreme Earthly Weather in an Electric Universe.
Okay.
And the idea is that a superstorm acts something like an electronic thermal pile, where heat energy is converted to electrical energy.
Mm-hmm.
And but then the other aspect, I had presented twice at the UN's climate change conference.
Mm.
And one of the things that I had spoke about was the idea that What I was taught in school is that the effects of what we do on the surface in terms of changing chemistry, it takes 15 years for it to have an effect on our upper atmosphere.
Hmm.
So if there are changes in the upper atmosphere, it's in reaction to what was done 15 years ago. So if that's the case, and climate change is rapidly advancing, the changes are going to occur from what was done years ago.
Right.
So it's only going to, you know, become even more unstable, and then changes happen.
All right, let's throw it over to our meteorologist.
Not an appetizing prospect. No, I mean, I just, you know, again, we tend to try to talk more about weather on the show than climate change. But in terms of that, yeah, then that's been the issue. Like, you know, the so-called tipping point that we've been hearing about for years. We may even understand where that tipping point is, or have at least an idea of where it is.
Yeah.
But we already may have passed it without even knowing it, to the caller's point about, you know, 15 years ago. Well, obviously we can't go back and change that. So
yeah,
we've got to make do with the best that we have at the moment. And hopefully, you know, we can get things moving in that regard.
Well, John, thank you for the call. Robert in Saugerties. Robert.
Yes. Can you explain to me what St. Elmo's fire is?
St. Elmo's fire.
Oh, St. Elmo's fire.
Yes, St. Elmo's fire, right, yes.
So there are just, I don't know a whole lot about it. I remember the movie.
Ah.
But no, St. Elmo's fire is...
No, I've actually seen it in the woods once in my life.
Yeah.
It's akin to static?
It is. And it has a kind of a greenish glow to it. It's not like the Aurora Borealis in that sense, but it
right.
Sailors had been reporting that for a long time, and they're, you know, you figure you're out in the ocean in these big tall ships,
the masts,
and you've got
of the
big masts, right, and all of that, so they can help to snag some of that discharge, and then depending on the wavelength, because ultimately that will determine what the color is, it will give it that. So you may have, I mean, atmospheric electricity is really something else, and it can be, obviously, the most extreme example of that is lightning, but it's always around, and certain things can get charged, and you can have, you know, these different opportunities for that. I'll tell you a story real quickly about that, not so much related to St. Elmo's fire, but just about electricity. I was on Lake George and was with my cousin and his wife, and she was standing up on the boat. We were in Bolton Landing, right in Huddle Bay.
Yeah.
Storm coming over the Adirondacks. No, there was no lightning with it. It was raining real heavily. Her hair started to stand up.
Oh, boy.
And I don't know that I've been so scared in my life. I told her to get down on the floor of the boat. I climbed up on the boat,
right,
turned it on, and just took off. We watched that storm cross the lake, Dome Island, and never threw any lightning, but it was getting ready to. So there is electricity in the atmosphere that doesn't always behave like lightning. And
all
that's,
right,
in essence, what St. Elmo's fire is.
Robert.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. There was a lot of smell of ozone as well.
Ah.
Yeah, you'll get that, right. That,
well, Robert, that. We have to leave it there, but thank you. Very interesting call. Jason, how do people find your website?
Just go to jasonsweather.com. You can sign up on there for a daily email forecast. I just put a whole bunch of updated ski forecasts on there, and I love writing the articles and lots of stuff to check out. So
get an intern. Get an intern.
I may have to do that.
4 o'clock in the morning, send out that email blast for you. Support comes from Luminary Media, a local full-service marketing agency and producers of Chronogram. Upstate house, upstater, explore the Hudson Valley at more. LuminaryMedia.com. Victory View Vineyard, Scaticoke, family-owned, specializing in growing northern grapes and crafting farm-bottled wines, wine tastings, vineyard and winery tours, and special events, victoryviewvineyard.com. The Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting Watermarks, new works by Deborah Gertzi, celebrating the Mohawk River Valley and landscape, waterway, and village views, through December 29th, arkellmuseum.org. And Vermont Coffee Company, organic coffee in the brown paper bag, available at local grocers. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Thanks once again to Jason Goff for being here today. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phones answered today by Jim Harrison. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, the folks from the Albany Distilling Company and Harvest Spirits Farm Distillery join Food Friday with their suggestions for New Year's Eve cocktails. That'll be fun, 2 o'clock tomorrow. Stand by now for the Capital Connection.